The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast, live from the Vintage Conservatory in Yorkville. Swanky place. We've got a private room. Shout out to Stephen Ranger for setting up yet another interview. I'll give him a plug off the top. Go to rangerwine.com, where you can find a lot of the wines. He brings in really cool producers, people that are focused on natural wine, or at least organic wine, or at the very least, wine that's made the proper way. And from Roussillon, which is in southern France, Moritz Back is joining me, the owner of Res Fortes. Moritz, thanks so much for being part of this.
Thank you very much. Great being here.
All right, let's start from the top. How much of your name or the vineyard did I screw up?
Luckily, nothing.
Really? So I nailed it?
That's perfect.
I get so insecure. The first minute of every interview I do, I'm always so insecure. I'm like, I'm going to screw up the name or the appellation or the winery or their last name or some sort of combination of all of them. So I'm glad I nailed it. Let's start here. You just had a baby daughter about a month ago. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. Three weeks ago, technically. Her name is actually Margot, spelt the French way with the X.
Really? Okay. Now I have a follow-up question. Was that your idea? Was it your wife's idea? Were you guys on board? Like, was this an equal decision to name your baby daughter Margot?
Technically, it was probably my wife. My wife, she was the one that went towards that direction, the Margot direction. We had some other names along the way, but she was more in favor of that. So,
if you were going to pick a name for your daughter that was based on your favorite wine region, not your own, you can't pick southern, you can't pick in Roussillon, you have to pick somewhere else, what would the name of your baby daughter be?
That's a good question. I mean, there's such...
Hold on. Is that a good question, or did you need a couple seconds to think about it so you said that's a good question?
Well, fair enough. I think you nailed it on the head there. I probably need a couple of seconds to think about that.
Would you name her Chamboul? Would you name her Cahors? Would you name her Otago? That'd be weird.
No, I think actually maybe Morgon. I love the Morgon region, Beaujolais. That's kind of I love that region. So probably I'd probably go for that one if I had to choose.
Everyone loves Beaujolais.
Everyone loves Beaujolais, right?
Everyone loves Beaujolais.
A good Beaujolais, you can't go wrong with that. A good Gamay, for example, that can't go wrong with that. So
how much sleep are you getting? You are a winery owner. You make wine. You have two children. How many hours of sleep do you get a night?
Oof. Well, it fluctuates a lot, to be honest, and it obviously depends on the season, if it's harvest or whatever's going on during the year. I don't know, I probably work like hours a week, probably like 60, 80 hours a week. And a lot of it is, it fluctuates, like as I said. Like also on the weekends, I probably work Sundays a lot, Saturdays, Sundays. Like it just really depends on what's going on and trying to fit family life in and everything. So it's not easy.
When was the last day you did nothing?
Oh, well, probably getting on that plane to come here.
So on your flight from southern France to Toronto, that was the least amount you have done in ages.
Yeah, it's actually really nice.
Yeah.
Just sit around and just wait for a plane. I mean, yeah. It was like glorious.
Please tell me you at least watched movies and you weren't going over text sheets or figuring out some issues with fermentation.
No. I watched the movies, had a couple of champagne, to be honest. I was a bit fortunate where I sat on the plane, should we say. I took advantage of like trying to take some time to myself, kind of chilled out.
Yeah.
I chilled out as much as possible.
All right. Let's talk about the winery. I was wondering if you first just tell people about the winery and where it's located, because you're the first person from that region of southern France that I've had on the pod, and I would love for you just to sort of give like a general sketch of the area and your winery.
So my winery, based in the Roussillon, right on the corner of on the Catalonia area, like right in sort of France, Spain, where we are based sort of half an hour, 40 minutes from the Spanish border. So we're sort of on the Mediterranean side, direction towards Girona, Barcelona, that kind of that part of the world. And I live in a tiny village called Mori. It's based in very close to a big city called Perpignan, which is again the Catalonia city. And then the region is known for sort of the old vineyards, old vines, Grenache is a classic, famous varietal that we grow there. And yeah, and so we've been to a very old area, to be honest, in respect to other regions of France. And we do we have the privilege of working with extremely old vineyards, which is pretty rare and sort of phylloxera free. Haven't had any issues there, so we're lucky with that we get to work with such old vines, 100-year-old vines. So we,
really,
yeah. So some of my vineyards are that age, which is very unique in retrospect to other parts of France. And so it's a real privilege to work in that area.
I want to get back to the winery in a second, but I was wondering if you could tell just what the difference is. What do vines that are around 100 years old, what do they bring to the wines versus 20 or 30 years? Because, you know, someone will go to a winery and the marketing person will say, well, our vines are 25 years old, our vines are 30, and everyone nods their head and go, oh, okay, that's old. But they don't really know how that translates into the bottle. I've seen 100-year-old vines when I was in Rueda, but I'm curious, what does it mean for the bottle?
Yeah, so for the bottle, it's, or for the wine,
yeah.
Basically sort of, it provides, well, the quality of the flavor profile, it really improves with, and also the ageability of the wine. So the wine becomes, as an example, my Brave that I have, that wine is our premium wine. It's from 120-year-old vines, but it provides the acidity, the longevity of it really enables the wine to be a sort of a more longer lasting, more mature aging kind of wine. Whereas younger vines, in order to get the flavor profile that you would get from older vines, it's just much harder to achieve that. The vines need to be stressed. So it's been stressed for 120 years as such. So that's just where the acidity, the flavor profile, the pH, all that kind of with age really develops, and which you can't get in a young vine. And so to produce top quality red wine, you need some age to it, such.
And what's the portfolio? What do you do for your winery? What are your main wines?
Yeah, so my main wines, we have six different labels. We have Grenache, 100% Grenache, 100% Syrah, sort of reds. We have reds, whites, and rosés. Those are the three different labels, but six different wines in total. We think. And we do, yeah, we have some estate wines, and also we have wines that we work with independent growers, and also we work with other wineries in other parts of France for other parts of our labels that we work with.
And you would say, would Grenache be the backbone? You mentioned it a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah, yeah. So Grenache is predominantly in our Brave, which is 100% Grenache, our premium wine. And then we have our GMS, which is our Grenache Mourvèdre Syrah. So normally a lot of people call it GSM, but we call it GMS.
Oh, because there's more Mourvèdre than Syrah?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So kind of a little bit different. And then, and then in terms of other Grenaches, like we use a lot of Grenache Blanc, Grenache Gris, which is a lot of the white grapes. And that's great for whites and rosés. And it's a lovely, different sort of unique from the region, but great wines to drink.
How did you, I'm judging by your accent, you were not born in the small town that you live in now.
That's correct.
Yes.
I was definitely not.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about your journey from, and we were talking before, when you were in high school, you were big into sound and tech and things like that. How you went from there to now, making high-end wine right near the border of southern France and Spain.
So I was born in Switzerland. I was lived in London my whole life. My father's from Holland and my mother's from Germany. Yeah, so I'm sort of a European kind of mixture, should we say. I've lived in, how I end up sort of living in Mori was where I live now. That was through my grandfather. He actually lived in Provence on the other side of where I live, Provence, near a town called Nice or Cannes, sort of in the mountains there. The Valbonne is the sort of in the mountains up there. So what happened was that in the summer holidays, we had fantastic. We were very fortunate. We went to, drove down from London back in the 90s, old style cars, back in all this Bluetooth in your car.
How old were you then?
We were eight, between 8 and 11, roughly, listening to our cassette tapes.
You're the Walkman. You're like the Walkman. Yellow Walkman.
Yellow Walkman in the car.
Yeah.
That was kind of the back in the day. And so we drive all the way down from London, catch the Eurotunnel under the sea all the way down. Sometimes you even put your car on a train and sleep on the train and drive all the way down. So he, so that, that's kind of like the, how I got into this sort of wine game, I guess. My grandfather was, he would never own vineyards, but he had a fantastic wine collection. He drank a lot of wine and encouraged us at a young age. Not, I wouldn't say encourage, but let us taste wine.
Of course.
Let us taste wine at a young age. And he and his wife, was a, my grandmother, was a fantastic cook. So it's sort of the combination of letting us taste wine at a young age and this fantastic French sort of Mediterranean style food. And so yeah, those were sort of one of the fundamental things that got me into where I am today. And secondly my father and my parents, we skied a lot, and they were big skiers as a family, and we went to Switzerland and France and see the Savoie and other parts of the vineyards on the steep, steep hills. And there I was like, thinking, like, how the hell do people grow vines on these vineyards? And so the combination of my grandfather and seeing these vineyards, I was hooked. I was kind of hooked onto the idea of, I want to learn more. I want to know how to do this. And that's kind of where how I end up today. So age 16, went to university, did a wine degree and traveled the world. And yeah, it's been a journey.
It makes sense. I think for a lot of people, I think it's just a certain person, if they experience what you experience at the right age, just suddenly you want to learn it all. It's like, how the hell do you do that? And it's the geography, the science, the weather and all of it, and just having sort of that natural curiosity. So I saw that you've worked at a bunch of places, Penfolds in Australia, Lausanne in Germany, and then in Bordeaux in California. I'm wondering, what are some main memories learning about making wine, let's say Australia versus Germany, which couldn't be more different?
Yeah, I mean, that was part of my learning experience, is why I wanted to do the university degree and travel the world. I wanted to see what the hell, Australia makes wine, all these different places. So Australia, I mean, it's hot, hot country, makes some fantastic reds. And obviously Germany, Germany, obviously Rieslings, you've got your Rieslings and all those kind of things. And so I wanted to, it's very different regions and climate are very different, and vineyards and the Mosel, for example, when I worked for Dr. Lausanne, are very different. Very different. So much going on, and so it was a real sort of eye opener to learning how to make fantastic Rieslings. And I remember there was one point where I was sort of on an evening shift as such, and we were working late. We started off at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and finished at 2 o'clock in the morning, and we were out cleaning presses at sort of midnight, and it got down to -8, and there we were trying to clean out the press and the water froze.
Oh.
So yeah, being -8, trying to clean out the press was not something you ought to really experience, but it certainly was an experience. So yeah, so whereas Australia was the opposite. It was 40 plus, sweating everything off, you know, and it's a real difference. But
well, that's cool. I mean, you get those experiences, then you get the big grandiose places in Bordeaux and the more modern California. That's a really cool sort of range of stuff, a lot of experiences. So then I'd love to hear about how you got to your current place, your winery now at Res Fortes. How did what's the genesis between you and that winery in that area?
Yeah, I was fortunate. So part of the university that I went to in the UK, it was called Plumpton College, which is now actually one of the main famous wine schools in the UK, and then they produce a lot of fantastic students, should we say. And so what happened was that part of the degree to become a viticulture and oenology was we had to get work experience, and there was a guy called Bob and Richard, and they lived in Moree, where I'm living now, and they were looking for students. This is back in 2009. I was looking for students to help in the vineyards and get work experience, and we needed the work experience. That's part of our degree, was to work somewhere. And so I got offered a job as a basically working in the vineyards for 2 months, starting in June to August. And I just fell in love with it. It was hot. It was pretty miserable, some of the work, but I mean, it was a real an eye-opener to see how much work goes into growing grapes. Like, it was a real good eye-opener for me, and I stuck with it and I loved it. That was in 2009, so I finished my degree in 2010. And then afterwards, I did that the whole, as you sort of mentioned earlier, I traveled around the world making wine in different regions. And part of my experience was I wanted to also come back to Mori and learn about the winemaking. I'd done the vineyard in 2009, but I want to learn the winemaking part and taste the wines and everything. So 2011, I went back to Richard and Bob, and they actually work for Orange Swift, which I'm presuming a lot of people heard, and maybe in Canada and America especially. So they work for the D66 label, and I worked with one of their cellar hands in 2011. And there, I just loved the winemaking that they did, loved the style of the wines. And I carried on working for other regions after that, but I just realized that after going to Australia, going to New Zealand, going to Germany, Bordeaux, and also Mori for me was just, it had the sort of the special vibe to it. There was something really special about it. And seeing these old vines of Grenache, it was just knowing what you can buy grapes at, if to buy grapes of 100 plus vines in Barossa, for example, like, you're going to pay a lot of money for it. And my family was in Europe. And so it was a combination of things that, to be able to start from scratch, to go to Barossa, for example, was hard work. Whereas I was in, and I want to be close to family. So Mori for me was the perfect sort of part of the world where it had the most options. And so I started there in 2014 and never looked back.
What was 2014 like for you? That was your first vintage, right?
Yeah.
And actually, correct some things, and I apologize for not having this off the top of my head. So it makes sense. You love the area. It was close enough from home. Far closer than Barossa. The real estate was less expensive, and 100-year-old vines far less expensive there. Did you buy this plot? Was this you and family? Just curious about that and how it connects with your first vintage in 14.
So basically, I went on from 2014. I just had a couple of good connections in Mori, and I worked with Richard and Bob, and I also said, hey, Richard and Bob, like, do you know any particular good wineries that I could maybe buy some grapes and work along with them, and maybe work for that particular winery and on the sort of help on the side, maybe make a couple of labels for myself. And they recommend me a winery called Master Levez, and that's where I started. So I worked with them in 2014, and I was fortunate to sort of buy some of their grapes and also help them in the cellar during harvest. And I made sort of 1,000 bottles of my white wine that I have, and 1,000 bottles of my red. And that was sort of the learning start to it, just sort of, because to buy land, it still was reasonably cheap in comparison to other parts of France.
But, yeah.
But it was more of, I didn't want to buy vineyards and then, oh crap, I can't sell the wine because I'm a useless winemaker or something. Because this is the first time I made wine for myself, right? I've always been... all the other wineries, I work for other people, and so that's why I decided to take less risk, buy some grapes, and start that way, and it's worked well so far.
What were those first wines like? That 1,000 bottles of red, 1,000 bottles of white.
So the white was Macabu. It was 6% Macabu, 20% each of Grenache Blanc, Grenache Gray, and they were sort of the, which we still have today, this wine, and it's like a fresh, citrusy, fruity, kind of very approachable, and with the Macabu, which I love, adds a nice sort of mid-body kind of to the style of white, which works really well with sort of the fresh Mediterranean kind of style foods. And then the reds, the GMS, the Grenache Mourvèdre Syrah, that was again more my kind of style. After sort of looking at other wines from the region, I wanted to pick the fruit a bit earlier to make it a little bit more fruit-driven. Fresh fruit driven, more not the full bodied, intense kind of characteristic, which is classic to the Roussillon, but I wanted to try and make it a bit more terroir driven, a tiny bit fresher. So we picked a bit earlier, which is not as common in the Roussillon or Mori. So just a slight different style to what traditional Mori is like.
How many bottles do you make now versus back then when you got started? I'm just curious about the growth over the last decade.
Yeah, so now we do 70,000 bottles. So it's grown quite a lot.
Yeah.
We have, we've had other labels along the way, but it's definitely grown and we, yeah, we transitioned from, so it's from 2014 to 2018. So that's when I realized, yeah, what I'm doing works to a degree. I'm happy with it. And I outgrew the winery I worked at. So I ended up, found some vineyards and a very small winery. I mean, it's not really a winery, like a shed, you know, like literally like a shed that you, yeah. Anyway, so it had, but it, so I purchased it's 14 hectares of organic vineyards with a basically shed that it had all the equipment, all the tractor equipment and tanks and presses and everything to start yourself.
What was that like? Make emotionally and mentally making that transition from, as you said, making wine for others versus now I'm making my own wine.
Oh, it was terrifying. I felt like I knew what I was doing, and I definitely made mistakes along the way, which I guess everyone does. But it was more of, you know, like you've got to sell this stuff. You've got to sell the wine. I mean, making wine is very easy. You can make tons of it, but if you don't know how to sell it, like it's. It's not going to move. So right. That was the hard bit about the process. And so that's, you know, that's why I wanted to start off small. I didn't want to just, I mean, I didn't have the money for one thing, but secondly, I wanted to start small and really see what am I doing works and can I sell it? And do I like actually making wine for myself and selling wine for myself? You know, do I like to go out and hit the road and do the tours and, you know, and that was why I spent the first 4 years learning. Mm-hmm. And I realized I did.
Speaking of learning, I was wondering if we could do just a little bit. I'm going to pick your brain to teach people a little bit about your area, because there's always stereotypes and generalizations when you don't know much. You start learning about wine, New Zealand. You go, oh, okay, it's a giant Sauvignon Blanc from Marlborough that's going to attack the hell out of me. Canada, oh, you just make ice wine. Roussillon, I mean, wait, isn't that Languedoc? Isn't that just all cheap red swill, you know, forgettable white wine? Like, if you're just starting to learn about wine, you probably don't know much about Roussillon. And I think I've pronounced it like three different ways. But I was wondering if you could just sort of tell people, okay, this is what the region is about. And more importantly, this is what our region is about when we care about our winemaking and our terroir.
Yeah, so the Roussillon is like schist soils. It's mm-hmm. the classic soils from the Roussillon. Roussillon has always been known for the bulk or large carved cooperatives, bulk wine, cheap. Well, I mean, cheap maybe a bit unfair, but basically low-end wine, low-end quality wine.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what the Roussillon has been known for. And the other challenge that's happened with the Roussillon is that nothing wrong to sommeliers, but a lot of wine connoisseurs, boffins, sommeliers, whatever you want to, you know, talk them about, but they associate Languedoc Roussillon as one region.
Big monoculture region.
And unfortunately, which I'm quite passionate about this part, I guess, is that Languedoc is humongous. Like it's, in terms of size, it's probably like in terms of wine region or in terms of size, it's probably the same size as like Australia wine. It's huge.
Wow.
It starts pretty much in Toulouse and ends up all the way in Marseille area. So it's a huge, and that's Languedoc, but we get Languedoc Roussillon is associated together. And unfortunately, but Roussillon is like a third of it, or not even a third of the Languedoc. So, and Languedoc over the years is flatland, a lot of flatland.
So perfect for bulk.
Bulk wine. And so, whereas you're in the Roussillon, you're on the foothills of the Pyrenees, and you have beautiful granite soil. And it's just terroir. You've got a mixture from also the Mediterranean. You get a lot of soils from the Mediterranean. Clay, like you've got a big diversity, and everything is, a lot of it done by hand. And the vineyards, they're on steep land. You can't drive a tractor up it, you know, and it's hard work. Whereas in Languedoc, big open land, plains, big vineyards. They're very different regions. And that's something that I think over the years is changing now. A lot more people are associating Roussillon as its own independent region. But again, it's a slow progress, and hopefully,
yeah,
it's just the quicker it, people understand Roussillon is one region, people I think will understand and appreciate the quality of the wines, the hard work that gets involved, and what it does. Yeah.
You got to get rid of that stupid hyphen, Languedoc hyphen Roussillon, where it's got to be. I think the big thing there is, as you mentioned, hills, schist, hand-picked. You know, you hear those things like, okay, it's got to be higher quality. I imagine there's an opportunity. The hard part's going to be to sell the wine, sell the story. But I imagine there's an opportunity where if wine is made well in your region, the quality would probably be a lot higher versus what the price is, because the land is going to be less expensive making a Grenache-based wine there versus, say, in Vaccarat.
Yeah, I mean, Vaccarat, like, yeah, the price, exactly, the price of the land is much cheaper in the Roussillon, just partly because of the history of it. And Vaccarat, like, it's 10 times as much, you know, mm-hmm. Vaccarat. So there's and that's, I mean, probably, you know, it's a hidden secret that the Roussillon is extremely valuable. Like, it's very affordable for land, for vineyards, for a hectare of vineyards. And that's why, like, it's a sort of a hidden gem as to what you can do.
Yeah, and I think it's important for this pod also, because I'm learning stuff about it. And I mean, I studied, you know, I got my diploma years ago, but, you know, we only got so far into where you're making wine. And also for people out there that are looking for value wines, well-made stuff that isn't going to break the bank. What is your Grenache? Like, when you think of the characteristic of Grenache in your vineyards, how would you describe it?
So for me, my talk specifically about my Brave, or just in general, I guess, because of my more pure label mm-hmm. is Brave, which is 100% Grenache.
We'll start there. Yeah.
So my Grenache, I get typical sort of the classic Grenache characteristics. The uniqueness I find with my Grenache is that the Brave vineyard is on a very high slope. Everything is pretty dangerous, like, hence why we call it Brave, the name. So we have to do a lot by hand. We get a lot of fantastic acidity, and we also get, it's a north-facing vineyard, so we get a lot of cool, very cool nights. We get the sunshine in the morning, which is great, and in the afternoon we don't get the, because it's not a south-facing vineyard, we still get sunshine, but it's, sunshine is facing the opposite direction, so we get much cooler afternoons, and then also much cooler nights. So it just helps with, like, the acidity and all those different things. But in terms of, like, characteristics, we sort of, yeah, the sort of the raspberry, sort of strawberry, kind of sort of more lighter, so we said red fruit, not the sort of the dark chocolatey kind of coffee. We don't get that. It's more mm-hmm. of the, on the lighter red fruit characteristics.
Yep.
That's what we get. So that's kind of what we like about it. And that really helps with ageability with the Brave. We have a fantastic acidity, which helps longevity of aging for the wine.
I'm excited. We're going to try the 2017 after I'm done yammering with you. All right, generalization alert question. How stylistically different would your GMS, got to make sure to say that properly, so Grenache, Mourvèdre, Syrah, versus, say, a well-made Cru Côte de Rhône?
Oh, I like this question. This is a good question.
Is this another good question where you need a second to answer it?
No, I think that the difference is the terroir. I think there's an element of terroir difference, but secondly, I guess is more of my style is more on the lighter front in terms of, like, the concentration level of the flavors that I'm trying to get. I think Côte de Rhône is a bit more intense in some elements of it, specifically more on the Grenache and maybe the more Mourvèdre areas. But and also, I guess, not many people do GMS, the more Grenache Syrah Mourvèdre, GSM.
Yep.
So I guess Mourvèdre is a fantastic grape, and a lot of people are a bit nervous about it.
That's because they haven't been to Bandol.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and some people don't even want to put, like, 100% Mourvèdre, because they struggle with people to understand that. Mourvèdre, I think, if you can play it right, work with it well, it really adds a fantastic blending component to a GMS. Hence why we've done that.
I don't think we're trying it today, but I'm always curious about the white wines of southern France. I always, like, white wine from northern Rhone is incredible. Southern Rhone, I recommend for people that are looking for something a little different than Chardonnay, but still like, you know, the body of Chardonnay. But I'm curious about your white wine program.
Yeah, so the white wine program, we do that. We three varietals, the Macabeu, Grenache, Blanc, Grenache, Gris. Previously, we would always done more heavy on the Macabeu, but we sort of changed it now to more heavy on the Grenache, Blanc, Grenache, Gris.
What does that bring?
It brings more freshness. We find the Macabeu, we find our wines age very well with the Macabeu, but stylistically people get a bit confused, and which I think is also a little bit of a shame. The Grenache Blanc and Grenache Gris, people understand the grape varietal more than a Macabeu, which in terms of the selling point, like that's kind of why we have actually changed it a bit, just so people understand Grenache Blanc or Grenache Gris more than Macabeu. And so program-wise, like the style of wine, we handpick the whites, three varieties, and then afterwards we then whole bunch press everything, and then after we've whole bunch pressed, we cold settle, ferment, and then we try and blend after fermentation. We then blend each varietal together and we try and do a bit of tank tank batonnage, lee stirring.
Mm-hmm.
And we try and make it sort of, yeah, the idea is to try and get a bit more body we're changing it with a Grenache Blanc, Grenache Gris, changing it a bit and trying to get more body on that, but using batonnage, lee stirring aspect to works.
This might be the hardest question because I find a lot of people have sometimes issues with selling themselves. I'm horrible at it. I know I'm loud, I'm an extrovert, I'm a radio host. I don't like selling me. But if you were going to sell your wines to the people listening, and the reason I don't think I've asked this question very often, because usually I'm interviewing people from more well-known regions, so people have a little bit more of a palate history with it. If you were going to sell your wines to people, how would you describe your overall winemaking philosophy and why they should try your portfolio?
Yeah, oh, good question. So for me, it's our wine is sort of more elegant, more modern. I travel the world making wine in Australia, New Zealand, sort of new world winemaking. And that sort of new world winemaking, I've tried to incorporate that into an old world winemaking region. And so, yeah, we get sort of less, well, we try not to use wood at all in all our wines. So we're trying to less wood focused, really terroir, really flavors from the actual vineyards. The other element is we find our wines are slightly more, the packaging is quite modern in comparison to what you see. We're not a classic Bordeaux, which obviously does make fantastic wines, but we are a wine that when you see it is very distinctive. Packaging is triangle labels.
I saw that.
Triangle labels. I love mountaineering, so we are you'll see a mountain of Canigou, which is a famous region, a mountain in the region, and someone on the top, that's supposed to be me climbing it, and I have climbed the mountain a couple of times. And so it's something where sort of, again, that's sort of the modern, elegant, distinctive wines that are very fresh and new to the region, and we are, yeah, we're special. You know, we've done well over the years. We've a special wine that has produced some award-winning wines, and I'm very happy with what's happened over the last almost 9-10 years, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, your first vintage making just 1,000 bottles each was a decade ago. By the way, do you fit in? Do you and your wine, or do you fit in your small town? Because you said you do a little more modern, a little more new world way. You're in small town southern France. I don't know if it's really more conservative there.
Yeah. So I guess it's actually another good question. But funny enough, a lot of people from not from the region are outside other parts of France, Burgundy, Bordeaux, are sort of Paris. They have all transitioned to the Roussillon. They also see the attraction that is there. And in terms of fitting in, I guess it is a little bit hard, but you know, this Dutch kid turns up, you know, what the hell is he doing? Oh, he thinks he can make the best wine, you know. It's changing. Like, that's what I love about the Roussillon. From, if you looked at 10, 15 years ago, like, it was a lot of cooperatives. And unfortunately, a lot of the cooperatives are fading out, and sort of they're more sort of merging with other bigger ones. And a lot more independent wineries or owners are moving to the Roussillon and slowly fitting in. You know, it is an old region. It's Catalonia, a very old region. And people are getting more used to So the older generation are getting used to more independent winemakers coming. And it's a really positive thing to see more independent wineries. And yeah, obviously a shame about Covetous for not working anymore. But again, like those vineyards that were owned by individuals are now being purchased by like myself and other people, and really continuing to really show what the Roussillon is about, like what is the fantastic opportunities it has. And so it's yeah, I'm very excited what's going on, and bring on more independent wineries and merge, you know, get used to the Catalunias, get used to these other Europeans turning up and taking over that, you know.
I'm excited to try your wines. It's a blind spot for me. I love a good Grenache, so I'm excited to try it. I was happy to hear that Stephen was able to put this together, and I can't wait to try your wines. Moritz, if people want to find you, websites, where do they go? If they want to find more information, again, rangerwine.com. Anyone listening to this who's like in the Ontario, Canada country region, that sounds stupid. I just forget where Stephen can ship from. Anyway, I'm talking too long. Moritz, where can people find your wines?
They're available in a variety of hotels and restaurants here in Ontario, or alternatively, I guess, on my website, which is resfortes.com. I mean, they're available all over the UK, all over, in a handful of states in America, hopefully more. And where else? Yeah, England, Canada, and America. Those are the three main countries that sell. We're available in Alberta, for example, and also in Vancouver and Manitoba as well, another place.
Nice. And as we end this, I guess even if they can't find your wines, if people are at wine stores and see wines of Roussillon, that they should at least go pick it up, try it, and see if they like it.
Completely. I think that's a good thing.
Moritz, thank you so much for being part of the pod today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, iTunes, Apple, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.